face. A little bit, I confess. But I'm trying to tell you to stop being invested in where this is leading and stop trying to steer it. Just follow where it goes. Virgil shades his eyes in the direction Jenna went. I don't know if Alice is a victim who ran to save her life or a perp who took someone else's life. But the night we were called to the sanctuary, Thomas was upset about Alice stealing his research. Kind of like he was today. You think that's why he tried to kill her? No, Virgil says. I think that was because she was having an affair.
Alice. I have never seen a better mother than an elephant. I suppose that if humans were pregnant for 2 years, the investment might be enough to make us all better mothers. A baby elephant can do no wrong. He can be naughty. He can steal food from his mother's mouth. He can move too slowly or get stuck in mud, and still, his mother is patient beyond belief. Babies are the most precious things in an elephant's life. The protection of the calves is the responsibility of the entire herd. They cluster with the babies walking in the middle. If they pass one of our vehicles, the baby is on the far side, with the mother forming a shield. If the mother has another daughter, 6 to 12 years old, they often sandwich the baby between them. Often, that sibling will come up to the vehicle, shaking her head to threaten you, as if to say, "Don't you dare! That's my little brother!" When it's the height of the day and nap time, babies sleep under the canopies of their mother's massive bodies because they are more susceptible to sunburn. The term given to the way babies are brought up in elephant herds is allomothering, a fancy word for "it takes a village." Like everything else, there is a biological reason to allow your sisters and aunts to help you parent. When you have to feed on 150 kilograms of food a day, and you have a baby that loves to explore, you can't run after him and get all the nutrition you need to make milk for him. Allomothering also allows young cows to learn how to take care of a baby, how to protect a baby, how to give a baby the time and space it needs to explore without putting it in danger. So theoretically, you could say an elephant has many mothers. And yet, there is a special and inviolable bond between the calf and its birth mother. In the wild, a calf under the age of 2 will not survive without its mother. In the wild, a mother's job is to teach her daughter everything she will need to know to become a mother herself. In the wild, a mother and daughter stay together until one of them dies.
Jenna. I'm walking along the state highway when I hear a car crunching on the gravel behind me. It's Serenity, of course. She pulls up and swings open the passenger door.
Let me at least drive you home, she says.
I peer into the car. The good news is that Virgil isn't in it. But that doesn't mean I feel like a heart-to-heart with Serenity, where she tries to convince me that Virgil is just doing his job. Or worse, that he may be right.
I like walking, I tell her.
There's a run of flashing lights, and a cop car pulls up behind Serenity.
Great, she says, and sighs.
And to me,
get in the goddamn car, Jenna.
The cop is young enough to still have zits, and a flat top as manicured as the 18th green at a golf course.
Ma'am, he says, is there a problem?
Yes, I say. At the same time, Serenity says, no. We're fine, I add. Serenity grits her teeth.
Honey, get in the car.
The cop frowns.
I beg your pardon?
With a loud sigh, I climb into the VW.
Thanks anyway,
Serenity says, and she puts on her left signal and pulls into traffic doing about 6 miles an hour.
At this rate, I'd get home faster if I did walk, I mutter. I poke through the trash that litters her car. Ponytail scrunchies, gum wrappers, Dunkin' Donuts receipts. An ad for a sale at Joanne Fabric, even though to my knowledge, she's not crafty in the least. A half-eaten granola bar, 16 cents and a dollar bill. Absently, I take the dollar bill and start folding it in the shape of an elephant. Serenity glances at me as I flip and crease and press.
Where'd you learn how to do that?
My mother taught me.
What were you, a savant?
She taught me in absentia. I look at her. You'd be surprised how much you can learn from someone who's completely disappointed you.
How's your eye?
Serenity asks, and I almost laugh. It's such a perfect transition.
Hurts.
I take the finished elephant and prop it in the little nook that has the radio controls. Then I shrink down in my seat, pressing my shoes against the dashboard. Serenity has a fuzzy blue steering wheel cover meant to look like a monster, and an ornate cross hanging from her rearview mirror. They seem about as far apart on the belief scale as humanly possible, and it gets me thinking, can a person hold tightly to two thoughts that look, at first sight, as if they'd cancel each other out? Could my mother and my father both be blamed for what happened 10 years ago? Could my mom leave me behind, but still love me? I glance at Serenity with her violently pink hair and the too tight leopard print jacket which makes her look like a human sausage. She is singing a Nicki Minaj song and getting all the lyrics wrong, and the radio isn't even on. It's easy to make fun of someone like her. But I love that she doesn't apologize for herself. Not when she curses in front of me, not when people in elevators stare at her makeup style, which I'd say is pretty much geisha meets clown. Not even when, it should be noted, she made a colossal mistake that cost her a career. She may not be very happy, but she's happy to be. It's more than I can say about myself. Can I ask you a question? I say.
Sure, sugar.
What's the meaning of life?
Well, Christ on a cracker, girl. That's not a question. That's a philosophy. A question is, hey, Serenity, can we swing through a McDonald's?
I'm not letting her off the hook that easily. I mean, someone who talks to spirits all the time can't just chat about the weather and baseball. Didn't you ever ask? She sighs.
Desmond and Lucinda, my spirit guide, said all the universe wants from us is two things. Don't do any intentional harm to yourself or anyone else, and get happy. They told me humans make it more complicated than it needs to be. I thought for sure they were feeding me a line. I mean, there's got to be more to it than that. But if there is, I guess I'm not supposed to know it yet.
What if the meaning of my life is to find out what happened to hers? I ask. What if that's the only thing that will make me happy?
Are you so sure it will?
Because I don't want to answer, I turn on the radio. By now we're on the outskirts of town anyway, and Serenity drops me off at the rack where I've locked up my bike.
You want dinner, Jenna? I make a mean Chinese takeout order.
Thanks, but no thanks, I say. My grandmother's expecting me. I wait for her to drive off so she can't see that I'm not going home. It takes another half hour to bike to the sanctuary, and 20 minutes to hike through the uneven brush to the spot with the purple mushrooms. My cheekbone is still throbbing as I lie back on the lush grass and listen to the wind play through the branches overhead. It's the hour that's the seam between day and night. Probably I have a concussion, because I fall asleep for a while. It's dark when I wake up and I don't have a light on my bike, and I'll probably be grounded for missing dinner. But it's worth it, because I have been dreaming about my mother. In my dream, I was really little, in nursery school. My mother had insisted that I go, because it wasn't normal for a 3-year-old to be socialized only with adult animal behaviorists and a bevy of elephants. My class had taken a field trip to meet Mora. Afterward, the other kids painted strangely shaped animals that the teachers enthused about, no matter how biologically inaccurate they were.
It's so gray! How creative to make two trunks! Well done!
My elephant paintings were not only precise, but detailed. I put the notch in Mora's ear, the same way my mother did when she sketched the elephant. I made the hair on her tail kinky, when every other kid in my class had completely overlooked its presence. I knew exactly how many toenails she had on each foot, 3 on the back foot, 4 on the front. My teachers, Miss Kate and Miss Harriet, said I was like a tiny little Audubon, although I had no idea what that meant at the time. Other than that, I was a mystery to them. I didn't watch television, so I had no idea who the Wiggles were. I couldn't tell the Disney princesses apart. Most of the time, the teachers took the quirks of my upbringing in stride. I mean, this was nursery school, not SAT prep. But one day, in preparation for the holidays, we were given sheets of fancy white paper and told to draw a picture of our family. We were then going to make a macaroni frame, spray it with gold paint, and put this inside as a gift. Other kids started drawing right away. There were all sorts of families. Logan lived with his mom alone. Yasmina had 2 dads. Sly had a baby brother and then 2 older brothers who had a mom that was different from his. There were various permutations of siblings, but it was clear that if there were extra people in the family, they were kids. Me? I drew myself with 5 parents. There was my father with his glasses, my mother with her flaming red ponytail, Gideon and Grace and Nevi, all wearing khaki shorts and the red polo top that was the sanctuary uniform. Miss Kate sat down next to me.
Who are all these people, Jenna? Are these your grandma and grandpa?
No, I told her, pointing. That's my mommy, and that's my daddy. That led to my mother being pulled aside at pickup.
Dr. Metcalf, Miss Harriet said, Jenna seems to have a little trouble identifying her immediate family.
She showed my mother the picture.
It looks completely accurate to me,
my mother replied.
All 5 adults take care of Jenna.
That isn't the concern, Miss Harriet said. It was then that she pointed out the spider writing, my disastrously spelled attempts to label these people. There was Mom holding one of my hands, and there was Dad holding the other. Except Dad wasn't the man I'd drawn with glasses. He was in a corner nearly pushed off the page. My happy little family unit was either wishful thinking or the uncanny observation of a 3-year-old who saw more than anyone expected. I'm going to find my mother, before Virgil can. Maybe I can save her from being arrested. Maybe I can warn her. Maybe the 2 of us can run off together this time. True, I'm going up against a private investigator who unravels mysteries for a living, but I know one thing he doesn't. My dream under the tree was what brought to the surface something I guess I've known all along. I know who gave my mother that necklace. I know why my parents were fighting back then. I know who, all those years ago, I wished was my dad. Now, I just have to find Gideon again.
Part 2. Children are the anchors of a mother's life. Sophocles, Phaedra, Fragment 612. Alice. In the wild, we often didn't realize an elephant was pregnant until she was about to deliver. The mammary glands would swell at about 21 months, but before that, short of doing a blood test or having witnessed a bull mating with a particular female nearly 2 years earlier, it was very hard to predict an impending birth. Kahiso was 15, and we had only just recently figured out that she was going to have a calf. Every day, my colleagues would try to spot her to see if she had delivered yet. For them, it was good field work, but for me, it became a reason to get out of bed. I did not yet know I was pregnant. All I knew was that I had been more tired than usual, listless in the heat. Research that had energized me before now seemed to be routine. If I did happen to witness something remarkable in the field, the first thought to cross my mind was, I wonder what Thomas would have made of that. I had told myself that my interest in him was due solely to the fact that he was the first colleague who hadn't mocked my research. When Thomas left, it was with the feeling of a summer romance, a trinket that I could take out and examine for the rest of my life, the same way I might save a seashell from a beach vacation or the ticket from my first Broadway musical. Even if I'd wanted to see if this rickety frame of a one-night stand could bear the load of a full-fledged relationship, it wasn't practical. He lived on a different continent. We both had our respective research. But, as Thomas had pointed out in passing, it wasn't like one of us studied elephants and one of us studied penguins. And due to the trauma of a life spent in captivity, there were often more deaths and grieving rituals to observe at elephant sanctuaries than there were in the wild. The opportunity to continue my research wasn't limited to the Thule block. After Thomas left for New Hampshire, we communicated through the secret code of scholarly articles. I sent him detailed notes about Mabo's herd, which was still visiting her bones a month after her death. He sent back a story of the passing of one of his elephants and how three of her companions stood in the barn stall where she'd collapsed, serenading her body for several hours. What I really meant when I wrote, "This might interest you," was, "I miss you." What he really meant when he wrote, "Thought of you the other day," was, "You are always on my mind." It was almost as if there was a tear in the fabric I was made of, and he was the only color thread that would match to stitch it back up. One morning, when I was tracking Kahiso, I realized that she was no longer walking with her herd. I began to search the vicinity and found her a half mile away. Through my binoculars, I spotted the tiny form at her feet, and I raced to a vantage point where I could better see. Unlike most elephants giving birth in the wild, Kahiso was alone. Her herd was not there, celebrating with a cacophony of trumpets and a pandemonium of touching, like a family reunion where all the elderly aunties rush to pinch the cheeks of a newborn. Kahiso wasn't celebrating either. She was pushing at the still calf with her foot, trying to get it to stand. She reached down with her trunk and twined it with the baby's, which slipped limp out of her grasp. I had seen births before where the calf was weak and shaky, where it took longer than the usual half hour to get it up on its feet and stumbling along beside its mom. I squinted, trying to see if there was any rise and fall to the chest of the calf. But really, all I needed to examine was the set of Kahiso's head, the sag of her mouth, the wilt of her ears. Everything about her looked deflated. She knew already, even if I didn't. I had a sudden flash of Laredo, charging down the hill to protect her grown son when he was shot. If you are a mother, you must have someone to take care of. If that someone is taken from you, whether it is a newborn or an individual old enough to have offspring of its own, can you still call yourself a mother? Staring at Kahiso, I realized that she hadn't just lost her calf. She had lost herself. And although I had studied elephant grief for a living, although I had seen numerous deaths in the wild before and had recorded them dispassionately, the way an observer should, now I broke down and started to cry. Nature is a cruel bitch. We researchers are not supposed to interfere because the animal kingdom works itself out without our intervention. But I wondered if things might have been different had we monitored Kahiso months earlier. even though I knew it was unlikely that we would have known further in advance that she was going to have a baby. On the other hand, I myself had no excuse. I didn't notice that I'd skipped my period until my cargo shorts no longer fit and I had to close them with a safety pin. After the death of Kahiso's calf, after I spent 5 days recording her grief, I drove off the reserve and into Polokwane to buy an over-the-counter pregnancy test. I sat in the bathroom of a peri-peri chicken restaurant, staring at the little pink line, and sobbed. By the time I returned to camp, I had pulled myself together. I talked to Grant and asked for a 3-week leave of absence. Then I left Thomas a voicemail, taking him up on his offer to visit the New England Elephant Sanctuary. It took less than 20 minutes for Thomas to call me back. He had 1,000 questions. Would I mind bunking at the sanctuary? How long could I stay? Could he pick me up at Logan Airport? I gave him all the information he wanted, leaving out one very critical detail. Namely, that I was pregnant. Was I right to keep this from him? No. Blame it on the fact that I immersed myself in a matriarchal society every day, or blame it on cowardice. I just wanted to take a careful, closer look at Thomas before I let him claim partial ownership of this child. I didn't know, at that point, if I would even keep the baby. And if I did, clearly I was going to raise it in Africa by myself. I simply didn't feel that one night under a baobab tree meant Thomas necessarily deserved a vote. In Boston, I stumbled off the airplane, rumpled and tired, stood in line at passport control, collected my luggage. When the doors belched me into the arrivals lounge, I saw Thomas immediately. He was standing behind the railing, sandwiched between 2 black-suited chauffeurs. In his fist, he was holding an uprooted plant upside down, like a witch's bouquet. I wheeled my bag around the barrier. "Do you bring dead flowers to all the girls you pick up at airports?" I asked. He shook the plant so that a little dirt rained down on the floor over my sneakers. "It's the closest I could get to a baobab tree," Thomas said. "The florist was no help, so I had to improvise." I tried not to let myself see this as a sign that he, too, was hoping we could pick up where we had left off, that what we'd had was more than a flirtation. In spite of the carbonation of hope inside me, I was determined to play dumb. "Why would you want to bring me a baobab?"
"Because an elephant wouldn't fit in the car," Thomas said, and he smiled at me.
Doctors will tell you that it wasn't medically possible, that it was too early in the pregnancy. But at that moment, I felt the butterfly flutter of our baby, as if the electricity between us was all she needed to combust into life. On the long drive to New Hampshire, we talked about my research, how Mabo's herd was coping after her death, how heartbreaking it had been to see Kahiso mourning her dead calf. Thomas told me, with great excitement, that I would be there for the arrival of his 7th sanctuary elephant, an African named Mora. We did not talk about what had happened between us under that baobab tree. We also did not talk about how I had found myself missing Thomas at odd moments, such as when I saw 2 young bulls kicking around a dung ball as if they were soccer stars and I wanted to share it with someone who would appreciate it, or how I woke up sometimes with the feel of him on my skin, as if his fingerprints had left a scar. In fact, with the exception of the plant he'd brought to the arrivals lounge, Thomas had made no mention of anything except our relationship as scientific colleagues, So much so that I was beginning to wonder if I had dreamed the night between us, if this baby was a figment of my imagination. By the time we arrived at the sanctuary, it was night, and I could barely keep my eyes open. I sat in the car as Thomas opened an electronic gate, and then a second, internal one.
The elephants are really good at showing us how strong they are. Half the time, when we put up a fence, an elephant will take it down just to let us know that she can.
He glanced at me.
We had a rash of phone calls when we first opened the sanctuary, neighbors saying that there was an elephant in the backyard.
So what happens when they get out?
Well, we get them back in, Thomas said. The whole point of living here is that they won't get beaten or hurt for escaping like they would have been in a zoo or circus. It's like a toddler. Just because a kid pushes your buttons doesn't mean you don't love him.
The mention of a toddler made me cross my arms over my abdomen. Do you ever think about that? I asked. Having a family?
I have one, Thomas replied. Nevi and Gideon and Grace. You'll meet them tomorrow.
I felt as if I'd been run through the chest with a spear. Had I never even asked Thomas if he was married? How could I have been so stupid?
I couldn't run this place without them, Thomas continued,
oblivious to the total internal breakdown happening in the passenger seat.
Nevi worked for 20 years at a circus down south as an elephant trainer. Gideon was her apprentice. He's married to Grace.
Slowly, I began to puzzle out the relationships, and the fact that none of those three people seemed to be his wife or offspring. Do they have children?
No, thank God, Thomas said. My insurance rates are already sky high. I can't imagine the liability of having a kid wandering around.
That, of course, was the right response. It would have been ludicrous to raise a child on a game reserve, just as it would be crazy to raise one on the grounds of a sanctuary. By definition, the animals Thomas took in were problem elephants, ones that had killed trainers or acted out in some way that made the zoo or circus want to get rid of them. But his answer made me feel like he had failed an exam, one that he didn't even know was being administered. It was too dark to see anything in the enclosures, but as we passed another high fence, I unrolled the window of the car so that I could smell that familiar, dusty, sweet grass scent of elephants. In the distance, I heard a low rumble that sounded like thunder.
That would be Sierra, Thomas said. She's our welcome committee.
He pulled up to his cottage and took my luggage out of the car. His home was tiny, a living room, a kitchenette, a bedroom, an office no bigger than a closet. There was no guest room, but Thomas didn't put my battered suitcase in his bedroom either. He stood awkwardly in the middle of his own house, pushing his glasses up the bridge of his nose.
Home sweet home, he said.
Suddenly, I wondered what I was doing here. I barely knew Thomas Metcalf. He could have been a psychopath. He could have been a serial killer. He could have been a lot of things. But he was the father of this baby. Well, I said, uncomfortable. Long day. Would it be okay if I took a shower? Thomas's bathroom was, to my surprise, pathologically neat. His toothbrush was in a drawer, parallel to the tube of toothpaste. His vanity was scrubbed spotless. The pill bottles in his medicine cabinet were organized alphabetically. I ran the shower until the small room filled with steam, until I stood like a ghost in front of the mirror, trying to see into my future. I showered beneath the hottest water until my skin was pink and raw, until I had worked out the best way to cut my visit short, because clearly, coming here had been a mistake. I don't know what I had been thinking. That Thomas had been 8,000 miles away pining for me? That he had been secretly wishing I would travel halfway across the globe to pick up where we had left off? Clearly, the hormones swimming through my system were making me delusional. When I stepped out in a towel, my hair combed through and my heels leaving damp footprints on the wooden floor, Thomas was fitting sheets and blankets on the couch. If I had needed any clearer proof that what had transpired in Africa had been a rogue mistake rather than a beginning, here it was, staring me in the face. "Oh," I said, as something broke inside me. "Thanks."
"This is for me," he said, averting his eyes. "You can take the bed."
I felt heat rising to my face. "If that's what you want." "You have to understand. There is a romance to Africa. You can see a sunset and believe you have witnessed the hand of God. You watch the slow lope of a lioness and forget to breathe. You marvel at the tripod of a giraffe bent to water. In Africa, there are iridescent blues on the wings of birds that you do not see anywhere else in nature. In Africa, in the midday heat, you can see blisters in the atmosphere. When you are in Africa, you feel primordial, rocked in the cradle of the world. Given that sort of setting, is it any wonder that recollections might be rose-colored?
"You're the guest," Thomas said politely. "It's whatever you want."
What did I want? I could have taken the bedding and slept alone on the couch, or I could have told Thomas about the baby. Instead, I walked toward him and let the towel I was holding around me fall to the floor. For a moment, Thomas just stared. He reached out one finger and traced the curve from my neck to my shoulder. Once, as a college student, I had gone swimming at night in a bioluminescent bay in Puerto Rico. Every time I moved my arms or my legs, there was a fresh shower of iridescent sparks, as if I were creating falling stars. This is how it felt when Thomas touched me. As if I had swallowed light. We ricocheted against furniture and walls. We did not make it to the couch. Afterward, I lay in his arms on the rough wooden floor. "You told me Sira was the welcome committee." He laughed.
"I can go get her if you want."
"That's okay. I'm good."
"Don't sell yourself short. You're fabulous."
I turned in his arms. "I didn't think you wanted to do this."
"I didn't think you wanted to do this," Thomas said. "I didn't want to make any assumptions, you know, that what had happened before would happen again."
He tangled his hand in my hair.
"Penny for your thoughts?"
"Here's what I was thinking. That gorillas will lie to deflect blame from themselves. That chimps deceive, and monkeys will sit high in a tree and pretend there's danger, even when there isn't. But not elephants. An elephant will never pretend to be something she's not." Here's what I said. "I was just wondering if we're ever going to get to do this in a bed." A white lie. What was one more? The land in South Africa often looks parched, its heels and elbows cracked with drought, its valleys baked red by the sun. This sanctuary, by comparison, was a lush Garden of Eden, verdant hills and damp fields flowering, muscled oak trees with their arms bent in fourth position, and, of course, there were the elephants. There were 5 Asian elephants, 1 African, and another African on the way. Unlike in the wild, the social bonds here were not formed by genetics. Herds were limited to 2 or 3 elephants, which had chosen to roam the property together of their own accord. There were some elephants, Thomas told me, who just did not get along. There were some who preferred to be on their own. There were others who didn't move 4 feet away from their chosen companion. It surprised me how much the philosophy of the sanctuary was like ours in the field. Just like we might want to rush in and save a gravely injured elephant, we wouldn't, because it would disrupt nature. We took our lead from the elephants and considered ourselves lucky to be able to watch unobtrusively. Likewise, Thomas and his staff wanted to give his retired elephants as much freedom as possible instead of micromanaging their existence. They might not be released into the wild in their dotage, but this would be the next best thing. The elephants here had spent most of their lives being hooked and chained and beaten to forced behavior. Thomas believed in free contact. He and his staff still went into the enclosures to feed the elephants and to medically treat them if necessary. But behavior modification was done only with reward and positive reinforcement. Thomas took me around the sanctuary on an ATV so that I could get my bearings. I rode behind him, my arms wrapped around his waist and my cheek pressed into the warmth of his back. The gates were designed with openings small enough for the vehicles to pass through, but too small for an elephant to escape. There were separate enclosures for the Asian elephants and the African elephants, and each had its own barn, although right now Hester was the only African elephant in hers. The barns themselves were giant hangars, so clean that you could practically eat off the floors. Heaters ran through the concrete to keep the elephants' feet warm in the winter, and heavy straps hung on the doors like the long fabric tongues of a car wash, so that heat could be retained in the winter, but the elephants could choose to go in and out. There were automatic watering mechanisms in each stall. "It must cost a fortune to run this place," I murmured.
$133,000, Thomas answered.
Each year?
Each elephant, he told me and laughed. God, I wish it were per year. I sank everything into securing the land when I saw the property advertised. And we let Sierra sell herself by inviting all the neighbors and the press to come see what we were doing. We get donations, but that's a drop in the bucket. Produce alone costs about $5,000 per elephant.
My Thule elephants had years of drought where you could see the macrame knots of their spines and the grooves of their ribs beneath the skin. South Africa was different from Kenya and Tanzania, where the elephants always looked comparatively fat and happy to me. But at least my elephants had some food. The property of the sanctuary was vast and verdant, but there would never be enough brush and vegetation to support the elephants here, and they did not have the luxury of roaming hundreds of miles along elephant corridors to find more, nor did they have a matriarch to lead them there. "What's that?" I asked, pointing to what looked like an olive barrel strapped to the steel grid of the stall.
"A toy," Thomas explained. "There's a hole in the bottom, and inside is a ball that's stuffed with treats. Dion has to put her trunk in and move the ball around if she wants to get the treats out."
As if he'd called her, at that moment, an elephant swept through the whispering straps of the doors into the barn. She was small and speckled, with a dusting of hair on the top of her head. Her ears were tiny compared to those of the African elephants I was used to, and ragged around the edges. The bony ridges over her eyes were pronounced, a hooded cliff. Those eyes were big and brown, so thickly lashed that they could have put a model to shame, and they were riveted on me, the stranger. I felt as if she was trying intensely to tell me a story, yet I was not fluent in her language. Suddenly, she shook her head, the same in-your-face warning behavior I was used to seeing at the game reserve when we inadvertently invaded the space of a herd. It made me smile, because her smaller ears didn't quite have the same intimidation factor. Asian elephants do that too?
No, but Dion was raised in the Philadelphia Zoo with African elephants, so her attitude's a little bigger than those of most of the other Asian girls. Isn't that right, gorgeous? Thomas said, sticking out his arm so that she could sniff at it with her trunk.
From nowhere, he produced a banana, and she delicately took it from Thomas's hand and tucked it into the side of her mouth. I didn't know it was safe to keep African and Asian elephants together, I said.
It isn't. She got hurt during a shoving match, and after that, the zoo staff kept her segregated. But they didn't have the space for that, so they decided to send her here to the sanctuary.
His cell phone started to ring. He took the call, turning away from Dion and me.
Yes, it's Dr. Metcalf, he said.
He covered the receiver, glancing back, mouthing, "The new elephant." I waved him away and then stepped closer to Dion. In the field, even with the herds that were used to seeing me, I never forgot that these elephants were wild animals. Wary, I held out my hand, the way I might have approached a stray dog. I knew Dion could smell me from where she was, across the stall. Hell, she could probably smell me from outside the barn. Her trunk lifted in an S, its tip swiveling like a periscope. The fingers pinched together, then snaked through the bars of the stall. I stayed very still, letting her brush my shoulder, my arm, my face, reading me by touch. With each exhalation, I smelled hay and banana. "Nice to meet you," I said softly, and she traced her way down my arm until her trunk found the cup of my palm. She blew a raspberry, and I burst out laughing.
"She likes you," said a voice.
I turned to find a young woman behind me, with a flaxen pixie haircut and pale skin so delicate that my first thought was of a soap bubble destined to burst. My second thought was that this woman was too tiny to do the heavy lifting necessary to take care of elephants. She looked young, hand-blown, fragile.
"You must be Dr. Kingston," she said.
"Alice, please. And you're...
Grace?"
Dion began to rumble.
"Oh, yes, I'm not paying attention to you, am I?"
Grace patted Dion on her brow.
"Breakfast will be ready shortly, Your Majesty."
Thomas walked back into the barn.
"I'm sorry. I have to run up to the office. It's about Mora's transport." "Don't worry about me. Seriously, I am a big girl, and I'm surrounded by elephants. I couldn't be happier."
I glanced at Grace. "Maybe I can even help." Grace shrugged.
"Fine with me."
If she saw Thomas give me a quick kiss before he left to jog up the hill, she didn't comment on it. If I had believed Grace to be weak, however, she proved me wrong in the next hour as she told me what her day was like. The elephants were fed twice, at 8 a.m. and then again at 4 p.m. Grace had to pick up the produce and make the individual meals. She would sweep out manure, pressure wash the stalls, water the trees. Her mother, Nevi, restocked the grain for the elephants and picked up the food left behind in the fields, which was delivered to the compost field. She also tended the garden that grew produce for the elephants and their caregivers and did office work for the sanctuary. Gideon took care of gate maintenance and landscaping, oversaw the boiler, the tools, and the four-wheelers, mowed the grass, stacked the hay, hauled boxes of produce, and did rudimentary elephant health care and maintenance. All three of them took turns doing training and being the overnight caregiver. And that was just on an ordinary day, one on which nothing went wrong or when an elephant did not need some special attention. As I helped Grace organize breakfast for the elephants in the barn kitchen, I thought, again, how much easier my job was at the game reserve. All I had to do was show up and take notes and analyze data, and every now and then help a park ranger or vet dart an elephant or administer some sort of medication to one who was injured. I wasn't running the wild, and I certainly didn't have to fund it. Grace told me that she had never intended to live this far north. She had grown up in Georgia and couldn't stand the cold. But then Gideon had come to work for her mother, and when Thomas asked for their help starting this sanctuary, Grace went along as a silent partner. "So you weren't working at the circus?" I asked. Grace dropped potatoes into individual buckets. "I was going to be a second-grade teacher," she said. "They have schools in New Hampshire." She looked at me. "Yes," she said. "I guess they do." I got the feeling that there was a story there, one I didn't understand, much like my silent conversation with Dion. Had Grace followed her mother here, or her husband? She was good at her job. But lots of people were good at their jobs without actually enjoying what they were doing. Grace worked with ridiculous speed and efficiency. I'm sure I was only slowing her down. There were greens and onions and sweet potatoes and cabbage, broccoli, carrots, grains. Some elephants needed vitamin E or cosequin added to their diets. Others needed supplement balls. Apples hollowed out with medicine inside and peanut butter on the top. We hauled the buckets into the back of the four-wheeler, heading out to find the elephants so that they could have breakfast. We followed dung and broken branches and prints in mud puddles to track the elephants from the places they were last seen the night before. If it was colder in the morning, like it was now, they'd be more likely to have moved to a higher elevation. The first elephants we located were Dion, who'd left the barn when we went in to prepare the food, and her best friend, Olive. Olive was bigger, although Dion was taller. Olive's ears draped in soft folds like velvet curtains. They stood close enough to touch, and their trunks were entwined, like young girls holding hands. I was holding my breath, and I didn't realize it until I saw Grace looking at me. "You're like Gideon and my mother," she said. "It's in your blood." The elephants must have been used to the vehicle, but it was still amazing for me to be this close while Grace hefted the first two buckets and dumped them out about 20 feet apart. Dion immediately picked up a blue Hubbard squash and crunched the entire thing in her mouth at once. Olive alternated food choices, following each bite of vegetable with a palate cleanser of straw. We continued this, going on a treasure hunt for the other elephants. I met them all by name, taking note of which elephant had a cut in one ear, which had an odd gait from previous injuries, which ones were skittish, which ones were friendly. They congregated in twos and threes, reminding me of the red hat ladies I saw once in Johannesburg, celebrating the good fortune of old age. It wasn't until we reached the African elephant enclosure that I realized Grace had slowed the ATV down and was idling outside the gate. "I don't like going in there," she admitted. "Gideon usually does it for me. Hester's a bully." I could see why she felt that way. A moment later, Hester came charging out of the woods, her head shaking and her massive ears flapping. She trumpeted so loudly the hair stood up on my arms. Immediately, I felt myself smile. This I knew. This I was used to.
I could do it, I suggested.
From the look on Grace's face, you would have thought I'd suggested that I sacrifice a goat with my bare hands.
Dr. Metcalf would kill me.
Trust me, I lied. If you know one African elephant, you know them all. Before she could stop me, I hopped off the ATV and lugged the bucket with Hester's food through the gap in the fencing. The elephant lifted her trunk and roared. Then she picked up a stick and whipped it at me. You missed, I said, my hands on my hips, and I walked back to the ATV to get the bale of hay. Let's not even begin to make a list of all the reasons I should never have done this. I didn't know this elephant or how she reacted to strangers. I didn't have Thomas's permission. And I certainly shouldn't have been lifting heavy bales of hay or putting myself in danger if I had any thoughts of keeping this baby. But I also knew never to show fear. So when Hester came at me as I was carrying the hay, her feet flying in the dust and creating a cloud around me, I stood my ground. Suddenly, I heard a loud bellow, and I was lifted off my feet and hauled outside the gap in the fencing.
Jesus, a man said. Do you have a death wish?
Hester lifted her head at the sound of the voice, then bent over her food as if she hadn't been attempting to scare the hell out of me a moment before. I squirmed, trying to get out of the iron grip of this stranger who was staring with confusion at Grace in the ATV, even as he held me in a vice.
Who are you?
He asked.
Alice, I said, my voice clipped. Lovely to meet you. Can you put me down now?
He dropped me on my feet.
Are you an idiot? That's an African elephant.
Actually, I'm the opposite of an idiot. I'm a postdoc, and I study African elephants. He was over 6 feet tall, with skin the color of coffee and eyes that were unsettling, so black I felt like I was losing my balance.
You haven't studied Hester,
he said under his breath, so quietly that I knew I wasn't supposed to hear him. He was at least 10 years older than his wife, who I estimated to be in her early 20s. He strode toward the ATV where Grace was standing.
Why didn't you radio me?
When you didn't come to get Hester's bucket, I figured you were busy.
She reached up on her tiptoes and wrapped her arms around Gideon's neck. The whole time Gideon was embracing Grace, he stared at me over her shoulder as if he was still trying to decide if I was a moron. In his arms, Grace was lifted off her feet. It was nothing more than a height discrepancy, but it looked like Grace was dangling from the edge of a cliff. By the time I wandered back to the main office, Thomas had disappeared, headed into town to make arrangements for the arrival of the tractor trailer that would bring his newest elephant to the sanctuary. Me, I hardly noticed. I wandered the grounds as if I were doing field research, learning here what I couldn't learn in the wild. I hadn't had much exposure to Asian elephants, so I sat and watched them for a while. There's an old joke. What's the difference between African and Asian elephants? 3,000 miles. But they were different. Calmer than the African elephants I was used to. Laid back, less demonstrative. It made me think about the gross generalizations we made about humans from those two cultures, and how the elephants followed suit. In Asia, you are more likely to find someone averting his eyes to be polite. In Africa, the head would be defiantly lifted and the gaze met directly, not to show aggression, but because that was acceptable for the culture. Sira had just waded into the pond. She was splashing around with her trunk, spraying her friends. A chorus of squeaking and chirping followed as one of the other elephants delicately skidded down the slope into the water.
"Sounds like gossip, doesn't it?"
a voice behind me said.
"I've always hoped they're not talking about me."
The woman had one of those faces that is difficult to judge by age. Her hair was blonde and pulled back into a braid, yet her skin was smooth enough to make me jealous. She had broad shoulders and ropey muscles in her forearms. I remembered my mother telling me that if you wanted to know an actress's age, no matter how many facelifts she had had, you should look at her hands. This woman's were wrinkled, coarse, and full of garbage. "Let me help you," I said, taking some of the refuse from her, gourd shells and husks and half a rind from a watermelon. I followed her lead, dumping them into a bucket, and then wiped my hands on the bottom of my shirt. "You must be Nevi," I said.
"And you must be Alice Kingston."
The elephants behind us were rolling in the water, playing. Their vocalizations seemed musical compared to those of the African elephants, which I knew by heart.
"These three are busybodies," Nevi said. "They're always talking. If Wanda wanders down a hill out of sight to graze and then walks up it again 5 minutes later, the other two greet her like she's been gone for years."
Did you know that the sound of an African elephant was used in the movie Jurassic Park for the T-Rex? I said. Nevi shook her head.
"And here I thought I was an expert." "You are, aren't you?"
I said. "You used to work at a circus?" She nodded.
"I like to say that when Thomas Metcalf rescued his first elephant, he also rescued me."
I wanted to hear more about Thomas. I wanted to know that he had a good heart, that he had saved someone on the brink, that I could depend on him. I wanted in him all the traits any female would want in the male she chose as the father for her offspring.
"The first elephant I ever saw was Wimpy. She was privately owned by a family circus that came every summer to the small town in Georgia where I grew up. Oh, she was wonderful. Smart as a whip, loved to play, loved people. Over the years, she had two babies, which also became part of that circus, and she treated them like they were her pride and joy."
None of this surprised me. I had long ago learned that elephant mothers put human ones to shame. Wimpy was the reason I wanted to work with animals. She was why I apprenticed at a zoo when I was a teenager, and why I got a job as a trainer when I finished high school. It was another family circus, this one in Tennessee.
I worked my way up from the dogs to the ponies to their elephant, Ursula. I was with them for 15 years.
Nevi folded her arms.
"But the circus went bankrupt and got liquidated, and I got a job with the Bastian Brothers Traveling Show of Wonders. The circus had two elephants that had been labeled dangerous. I figured I'd make that judgment call myself after I met them. So you can imagine how surprised I was when I was introduced to the animals and realized one was Wimpy, the same elephant I'd seen as a kid. At some point in her life, she must have been sold to the Bastian brothers."
Nevi shook her head.
"I never would have recognized her. She was chained up, withdrawn. I wouldn't have identified her as the elephant I used to know, even if I'd been watching her all day. The second elephant was Wimpy's calf. He was housed across the way from Wimpy's trailer in an enclosure made of hot wire.
On the ends of his tusks were little metal caps that I had never seen before. As it turned out, that calf wanted his mama and kept tearing down the hot wire to try to get to her. So one of the Bastian brothers had come up with a solution to put those caps on the calf's tusks and wire them to a metal plate in his mouth.